in the occupied West Bank, pledging its commitment to the so-called two-state solution. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Tuesday met with Palestinian Authority Prime Minister Rami Hamadala in the West Bank city of Ramallah, where he said there is no plan B for the two-state situation. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu recently vowed to never uproot any West Bank settlement, saying the Tel Aviv regime would never remove any of the more than 100 Jewish settlements in the territory that Israel captured in 1967. Netanyahu's comment enraged Palestinians and raised new questions about the slow start for the so-called peace efforts led by the White House advisor Jared Kushner. Palestinians have expressed frustration with U.S. President Donald's approach and are trying to ratchet up international pressure for a settlement freeze.
If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
On the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
Aung San Suu Kyi's problem is that she has to balance her fight for democracy with appeasing interests that will hurt the Rohingyas. And apparently the pressure from the army, because she is in no way in command, she is fighting the army to get more democracy. The pressure from the army on the one hand and the pressure from civil society, which is anti-Muslim on the other, is so strong that she can't be seen to be in favor of the Rohingyas or she will lose legitimacy in the eyes of many Burmese. It's not a very popular thing to say, but she is in a fix.
This is Vagabond, producer, writer, and director, Machetero. You're listening to The Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Okay, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. We don't get a chance to really discuss the topic of Indian people very much because I'm trying to get someone on the show that has first-hand knowledge of what is going on in the country. And because of safety concerns about what could happen to them, their government, or the idea that if they left the country and spoke on the subject that they might not be able to return to Burma, we have Joe Hinson from the Netherlands. He is an activist. He's been working on this issue for about 5 years. And to give us some light on the subject. Now, for many people in the West, especially in the United States and Canada, we're really not aware of what is happening. Most of the international media, especially the media in our home states, tends to be focused on Islam in a negative light. So there's talk about Islamic terrorism, there's talk about Islamic misogyny, there's a lot of this. Doesn't mean that there is some truth to it and that it doesn't have merit, but there are also Muslim minorities around the world that do face oppression. One of the biggest offenses that's going on right now in terms of the Asian scene is happening in Burma. Now, the activist, the democracy activist, Aung San Suu Kyi, is now part of the Burmese government or Myanmar government. There's a colonial discussion about the name. I mean, the entire situation is very, very dark. And while no one is discrediting her stance, her fight for democracy in the country, the struggle that she's had to endure, the fact that she has not spoken up for rights, human rights, the basic justice that's happening, this is really what is happening in people's genocide. She has said nothing other than there is no problem. The international community is finally begun to speak up about this, and I understand this morning she is facing heavy, heavy criticism for her choice, for her decision to not address this issue now that she is part of the government. We're going to move on now and speak with Mr. George Hinson. I wanted to ask someone who doesn't have the same security issue, but again, has a finger on what is happening, what's going on there. And, George, welcome to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
How do you do?
I'm fine, thank you. And you? It's nice to hear you.
If you could explain for our listeners, please, what is the basic situation in Perth/Hyamal, and what is the view of the international community from what you can gather in terms that people who have no understanding of the situation but have a somewhat jaundiced view of Islam, with no understanding of indigenous issues, how can one understand what is happening?
Well, thank you for letting me in the show. Let me make clear who I am, basically. I'm one of the persons behind Protect the Rohingya, and on Twitter, Rohingya Sources as well. So you could call me a kind of a Rohingya activist. I've been trying to raise attention for the Rohingyas for about 5 years now, with varying success. It's not really a topic people are really interested in. It's a surprisingly complicated problem. I'm an academic myself, and I have done some research on the problem, which is surprisingly complex. It's not something that will be solved today or tomorrow, but it is something that needs quite a lot more attention, or a lot of people will be getting killed. I'm an advisor to the board of direction of University of for Applied Sciences. By training, I'm a sinologist. I study Chinese. I'm a specialist on Chinese politics, and I also have a law degree, and I have a long experience with asylum cases. I was an official for the Dutch Immigration Service. That is also how I came to be interested in the Rohingyas, because we had some Rohingyas asking for asylum in the Netherlands, and that's how I became interested in their problems. And I teamed up with a wonderful lady from Johannesburg to form Protect the Rohingya. And the Rohingyas are really one of the passions of my life. I would really love to help those people get a decent life in prosperity and peace and security. But basically what's happening is that one group of people is trying to expel another group of people from the land. If they won't go freely, they will be killed. This has been going on for decades now, with high points in 1979 and 1992, 2012 and now again. But that's only one part of the story. Another part of the story is that Burma or Myanmar is a country with many nationalities. And the people in Rakhine State are the cousins of the Burmese, and have only recently been conquered by the Burmese, shortly before the English colonized the country. And So there is an internal dynamic as well, that the Burmese don't want to upset the Arakanese or the Rakhine people, and are giving them kind of free hand to go along and expel the Rohingyas. Then there is a third layer as well, that because of the colonial past, many Burmese think that Muslims and people who look like Indians from India have been introduced into the country because of the British, and that they should be expelled, that they don't belong in the country. Although that was true for central Burma, this area really, research shows that the Rohingya are actually the original population, and that they've been there for centuries. But this does not fit very well with the nationalistic Buddhist ideology of the Burmese and the Rakhine State people. So all of this makes into a very explosive mix that is only compounded by the fact that the area is extremely poor. and that there is great pressure on the land for resources and room to live. And that the Rohingya are a very easy scapegoat for the population to expel.
Okay,
my basic picture of it.
Yes, I see that you've co-written a book, or co-edited a book, Protect the Rohingya. What was the reception to this volume in the Netherlands and across the European Union?
Well, it's really fair way. People are not really aware of the problem. As you say, they're Muslims. Without being a believer in anything, there are more than a billion Muslims. But in Europe, really, the Rohingya problem isn't really a problem. We have been trying to raise awareness for the problem in the past 5 years. Both Rohingyas and others, supporters, been trying to raise awareness of the Rohingya problem. But to be honest, there are other and major problems in the public mind. So it is extremely difficult to get the attention of the larger public. We are aware of initiatives by Western diplomats and the ASEAN, and also from China, really, now, that there are attempts to mitigate the problem, and there is pressure certainly on the Burmese government to stop genocide really from happening. But I don't think that those efforts are really successful.
Well, what is the position of the United Nations on this? And in your answer, if you're aware of the answer, what is the position of the United States government in relation to the position of the United Nations in this issue? Because there was a lot of waffly support for Aung San Suu Kyi and what her movement was about from the United States. You know, there was a lot of lip service,
yes,
but there wasn't a lot of actual support. And now that this crisis has been on, and as you said, it's been ongoing, very rarely mentioned at all. If it wasn't for the independent and somewhat, alternative news wires, I would not have even known about this situation.
Yeah, that's true. We've had some small successes. The alternative media, as you would call us. For instance, the Burmese government has always opposed the term Rohingya. And during a visit of President Obama to Burma, he did use the term. And we lobbied for him to use it. That was a small success. So there are really small successes. But the problem is that to most countries, this area of the world is rather a backwater, and it's very poor. So there is not a lot of interest. A couple of years ago, gas was found in the sea of the Gulf of Bengal, close to Rakhine State. And the Chinese have been very active there. They've always also tried to build infrastructure from China, from the south of China, towards the coast, so that they can extract the gas, but also have access to harbors there, which makes it a geopolitical problem for the Americans. The Rohingyas are basically caught in between, because I read Chinese. As I've seen in the past couple of days, the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs has been voicing its disquiet about the social repression that has been taking place. But it's very muted, because Burma is an ally. And that is really the problem with the plight of the Rohingya, is that everybody really would like democracy in Burma, in larger Burma, to succeed and to have Burma as a friend, because there are larger political and economic interests at play here. And the problem really is that the more democracy you get, especially in Rakhine State, you have a catch-22 situation, because who isn't against democracy? But if the democratic majority of a part of the country is in favor of expelling an entire group of people, you have a problem. And that is what has been playing out now.
Yeah, now, one of the things that I wanted to mention in terms of media reporting, in the United States, there was virtually no reporting of it. Now, I have managed to find an April 6th of this year report from James Griffiths of CNN, mentioning Aung San Suu Kyi saying that there is no ethnic cleansing of Muslims in the country. And then you have the U.S. edition of the Manchester Guardian with a headline here that says Aung San Suu Kyi rejects the United Nations inquiry into the crimes against the Rohingya. So when we see this, someone in her position, you know, I kind of want to focus on Aung San Suu Kyi for a moment. As for someone in her position, how can she deny a United Nations inquiry into a human rights violation happening within her own nation?
I have to say that my position on this isn't really a general position that Rohingya activists would take. But as I see it, if you look at Burma, about two-thirds of the population are Burmese. The Burmese have a problem. It's called military dictatorship, and they want to get rid of it. And in their fight to get rid of the military dictatorship, they're using all the support they can get. And as far as this is concerned, there are, as I said, two stories going on. One is the colonial, anti-colonial story of expelling all the people who have been introduced into the country by the British, who make up a sizable Muslim majority. And then you also have the locals' problem between the Rakhine, the Arakanese, and the Rohingyas, with the Buddhist nationalism playing. The Burmese need the support of the Arakanese to have peace in Rakhine State. So Aung San Suu Kyi's problem is that she has to balance her fight for democracy with appeasing interests that will hurt the Rohingyas. And apparently the pressure from the army, because she is in no way in command, she is fighting the army to get more democracy. The pressure from the army on the one hand, and the pressure from civil society, which is anti-Muslim, on the other, is so strong that she can't be seen to be in favor of the Rohingyas, or she will lose legitimacy in the eyes of many Burmese. It's not a very popular thing to say, but it's she is in a fix.
Okay, that's good to understand, because, you know, a lot of us have been pretty, you know, admittedly black and white about that, you know, that subject. You know, that how could someone who has been in the, you know, at the forefront of a of a liberation struggle not understand, you know, what was happening to this minority? And then, you know, I have to ask, before we go into our next segment, the question of racialism. Because, you know, a lot of us here, even those of us who are indigenous, we're not from Burma / Myanmar.
Yes.
What is the difference between Burma and Myanmar? What do those terms mean? How many ethnic groups are in the country within its claimed borders? And the usual question of who really belongs there in the political sense. You know, how can those of us in the West who are trying to suss this out navigate this?
Okay, the story is, as I said, it's very complicated. Historically, you had the state of Arakan that was that existed from at least the 15th century till the end of the 18th century. And it spanned the coast of Burma and what is now Bangladesh. The northern part of Arakan was where now you have the Chittagong tracts of Bangladesh. The country was bitten in two, basically, by the Sultan of Dhaka in the north, who is a Muslim, and who took over most of the Muslim parts of the country. In 1785, the Burmese took over what was left of Arakan, the southern part. But the population was mixed. In the north, you had a majority of Muslims who look like Indians, basically, and speak a language that is not Bangla, but is close to Bangla. And in the south, you have a population that is a majority Hindu or Buddhist, and who look like Burmese, who speak a language that is to Burmese, but isn't, and they are the Arakanese. So this country was bitten in two, but the conquest didn't follow the linguistic frontier. The northern part of Burmese Arakan was solidly Muslim. So and you also had originally a lot of villages, Muslim villages to the south, that were Muslim. These were ethnically cleansed during the 40s and 50s. Because this problem goes back a long time, you know? On the other side of the Bori in Bangladesh, you also have Arakanese Buddhists, the Mon. They're the same as the Rakhine State people, the Burmese kind of people. They are also being discriminated against in Bangladesh, although not as badly. So the problem is on two sides of the border. And the area is extremely poor. So this is really the central problem, that Arakan State was bitten in two. And even before the British colonialism, you had Burmese imperialism taking over Arakan State. And they didn't like the Muslims there. This was put on hold because of the colonial period under the British. But it resumed in 1948 when the territory was given to Burma again. Now, Burma originally had a democratic government with a strongly religious slant to it. But later on, it got a military dictatorship. And the country that was called Burma was rebaptized Myanmar by the military government. Myanmar is basically closer to the way the Burmese call their own country. Burma is a British term. But in the mind of many Burmese who are pro-democracy and anti-military regime, Myanmar is the name of the oppression of the military regime. So it has a political value to it as well. And to this very day, pro-democracy activists would rather call the country Burma, whereas people who support the regime call it Myanmar.
Yeah, that makes sense, because when I've attended lectures, talks really, they were small discussion groups, I noticed that I have a hard time with Myanmar, but it was more of an emotional thing. I mean, it wasn't something I asked, they could say that I had any conscious thought about. Burma does seem to be more legit, even though now, after what you said, that adds to the confusion, because Burma is connected to British colonialism, and then, as you identified, Myanmar's connected to the current state of affairs. So we're going to take a break for a moment so stations can identify themselves. This is the Angry Indian, and I'm speaking with Professor George Hinson, University of Applied Sciences, and we're discussing the human rights issue that is going down in Burma, because the West really doesn't know enough about it. Indigenous people in the West, we really don't know very much. And it is one, as far as the United Nations is concerned, it is the most damning human rights issue. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Mm-hmm.
Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid from The Horn, headonradionetwork.com, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Information is the best way to protect your health. Plan B, an emergency contraceptive, is now available over-the-counter, without a prescription or a doctor's appointment, for women 17 years and older. If you have had unprotected sex or have been sexually assaulted, consider Plan B to prevent an unwanted pregnancy. You have a legal right to get Plan B without a doctor's prescription. For more information, call your local Indian Health Service. If your local IHS does not carry Plan B, request that they do. Contact your local tribal health board and let them know about Plan B so they can make sure IHS provides it. For more information, call 605-487-7072. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
I'm gonna stand until I can't stand no more if I have to stand by myself.
The American people are the last people to wake up.
Prisons are becoming an integral part of the U.S. economy.
People of color organize critical thinking, strategic work, and direct action for social, racial, gender, and economic justice.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
People of Color Organize features intersections of race, politics, feminism, movement, class, internationalism, and theory.
This is about the Black Panthers. This is about the American Indian movement. This is about all of us.
Visit us online at peopleofcolororganize.com. Follow us on Twitter at POC Organize and Facebook at facebook.com/peopleofcolororganize. You can also find us on Tumblr at peopleofcolor.tumblr.com.
We're organizing against what we term genocide.
तपाईलाई थाहा छ नेपालमा पहिलो पटक कहिले एचआईभी संक्रमित व्यक्ति फेला परेको थियो
थाहा छ सन् 1988 मा
यतिका वर्ष बितिसक्दा एचआईभी एड्स को क्षेत्रमा के भए सकारात्मक परिवर्तनहरू कति आए कसले के गरे
के हामीले आफ्नो जिम्मेवारी वहन गर्यौं तपाईले गर्नुभयो
जवाफ आफैसँग खोजौं जिम्मेवारी वहन गरौं
सामाजिक रूपान्तरणका लागि गगन गृहको एउटा प्रयास
Radio Insurgente, la voz de los sin voz.
Vamos, 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 vamos adelante, para que salgamos en la lucha avante, porque nuestra patria grita y necesita de todo el esfuerzo de los zapatistas.
Transmitiendo desde algún lugar de las montañas del sureste mexicano, en la frecuencia 99.7 en FM.
How I've been affected by gun violence over the years is through deaths of friends and family members and associates.
When I was 5 years old, I was held at gunpoint in a home invasion.
I've gone to the juvenile detention centers and I've met dozens of young kids, babies really, who have been affected by gun violence.
Directly, I've lost a few friends, but I think what why this touches my heart is having children of my own.
You know, I've been at parties where, you know, I had just left the party and, you know, maybe 10, 15 minutes later, you know, I heard that, you know, somebody got shot and didn't make it.
There are a lot of people benefiting off of our pain, and it's time we do something.
I'm here to unload my investment because I think that it's important that we start kind of seeing where our money is going.
It's time to go to your financial advisor and demand that there are no gun investments in your 401k.
Even if you don't have investments, you can still help spread the word.
This is something everyone can do.
So if you push your people to have 401ks, it might be your grandma, it might be your cousin, this effort can make a big impact.
I'm unloading for my loved ones that I lost
I'm unloading from my 18-year-old self.
I'm unloading my 401k for the future of my children.
I'm unloading.
I'm unloading for my family and their future.
I'm unloading so that my daughter can grow up in a safe, loving world.
Unload and join the movement.
Use hashtag I'm unloading to pledge your support for gun-free investing.
Всех сухожилий, но сегодня опять как вчера обложили меня, обложили, гонят весело на номера и заели, хлопочут двустволки, там охотники прячутся в тень, на снегу кувыркаются волки, превратившись в живую мишень. Идет охота на волков, идет охота на серых хищников, матерых и щенков. Кричат загонщики и лают сыта рвоты, кровь на снегу и пятна красные в башков. Не на равных играют с волками егеря, но не трогнет рука, оградив нам свободу флажками, бьют уверенно наверняка. Волк не может нарушить традиции. Видно в детстве слепые щенки. Мы волчата сосали волчицу и всосали нельзя за флажки. И вот охота на волков, идет охота на серых хищников, матерых и щенков. Кричат загонщики и лают сыта рвоты, кровь на снегу и пятна красные флажков. Поминовения вышел за флажки, шашка жизни сильней. Только сзади я радостно слышал удивленные крики людей. Рвусь из сил и всех сухожилий, но сегодня не так, как вчера. Обложили меня, обложили, но остались ни с чем егеря. Идет охота на волков, идет охота на серых хищников, матерых и щенков. Кричат загонщики и лают сыта рвоты, кровь на снегу и пятна красные флажков.
Hey, this is Jonathan Colton, and you're listening to a podcast released under a Creative Commons license. CC, baby. Check it out.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
This is FSNN reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression, and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
This is Violent Fanon, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Okay, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome back. I'm speaking with Professor George Simpson of the Hague Academic Community, and, you know, we're talking today about what is happening in Burma in terms of the Rohingya people and how British colonialism has affected, in many ways, the current state of affairs in terms of what is going on, and how when colonialist states usually tend to fall to the side, military orders take effect, right? You know, those who led the struggle, those who led the opposition, or the members of the army that were able to survive the transition it's almost always questionable. I talk here in terms of the French Revolution about Robespierre. You know, we really have to be careful about nationalist movements. We have to be careful about ethnic centered movements, because when you start playing, you know, with racial purity arguments, you know, you're always playing with fire. And, you know, for people who practice Buddhism, this is one of the biggest questions that I have been receiving from the American Buddhist community, those who are aware of the situation. How can the Buddhist community of Burma go against another religious group that they really have not had any conflict with, and the racial component? You know, Buddhism is supposed to be above this as either a philosophy or as a religion. How would you, coming from the Netherlands, a society that, even though you have Geert Wilders, you know, for the most part, people are much more cognizant of the world and have a much broader view and much more tolerance in terms of understanding and trying to export that understanding of religious tolerance. You know, how is someone supposed to view this when we look at the reputation of Buddhism as a religion and as a philosophy, and then we hear genocide being performed by Buddhists?
Yeah, you ask very difficult questions, really. You know, it's all about people. It doesn't really matter what you believe. It's all about people. And religion and emotions often serve to obscure our humanity. Unfortunately, these happenings have been influenced in an important measure by Buddhist nationalism that it comes from Sri Lanka. At the end of the 19th century, there was this movement of Buddhist nationalism that opposed the Tamil, Hinduist, and Muslim communities on Sri Lanka, and wanted to impose a purely Buddhist order. This movement had more to do with modern nationalism, and I wouldn't call it racism, but racialism, at least, between the different peoples on the island of Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka has had a very special role in the spread of Theravada Buddhism, Southeast Asia, first contact, Rakhine State. The clergy influenced by this Buddhist nationalism, which isn't religion really, because according to Buddhism, out of the world, the priests. It's a long story. Okay. Well, the gist of it basically is that in Rakhine State there is a local Buddhist nationalist movement, in part that has spread to the rest of Burma, but which is very. Very influential in Rakhine State, which pleads for a Buddhist nationalism which does not accept any other communities in Rakhine State. It has a religious dimension in the sense that it would like to chase away all Muslims, but it also has a racial dimension in that the stories go that the Buddha was really looked like a Burmese, and that people who are not Burmese are inferior. The Rohingya are called Kala, the blacks, because they are dark Hindustanis. I have to say these are really all stereotypes, because of course the population has really been mixed. So you have really Hindustani-looking Buddhists and really Burmese-looking Muslims. But in the world of stereotypes, there is a racial component to this Buddhist nationalism. which seeks to purify, in a way, the country. If you combine this with the poverty and the lack of land and the lack of resources, you get a very explosive mix to kick the Rohingya out of the country.
Well, let me ask you this. The anti-Muslim or Islamophobic movement, I suppose for lack of a better term, that is happening in the Netherlands and is currently led or personified by Kurt Wilders. There's a few people I can think of, but right now I'm thinking of him. What is their position on the anti-sentiment or the anti-Muslim push that is occurring? Or do they have a position?
Not that I'm aware of. They're simply not interested in the problem. If you look at Geert Wilders, I would say personally, you will know that I'm not a fan of Geert Wilders, or of anybody of any party that is close to his views. But I would say that Geert Wilders is little bit a has-been in Holland. He's had about five or six elections to prove himself. He's never come on top. He's never been the biggest in Holland. No party ever gets a real majority in Holland anymore. We are a lot like Scandinavian countries where we have cabinets, coalitions with more parties. But all other parties shun Geert Wilders. And Geert Wilders is really... He used to be a very fine debater. Not that I liked his arguments, but he was good at it. But it's gone now. He's a spent force.
Okay, I understand what you're saying. That is in the Netherlands, but in the United States, the far right has given him resistant prominence. And I'm just kind of curious. Because
I know.
They have started to branch out their politics a little bit to try to be more inclusive. So you have neo-Nazis in the United States, the UK, Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, France, that I'm aware of, who are pro-Israel. They're pro...
You could say that Geert Wilders is a Dutch form of Likud. He's a Dutch form of the Israeli party Likud. But then within a European, within a Dutch setting, which is completely different. And if you want to look at the relevance of Holland for the United States, there is a real relevance that is in a different but a much more surprising direction. Is that in Holland the conservative Christians, the Calvinists, are very, very close to the religious right in the United States. People like the Prince family of Blackwater, they come from Dutch families. And we have a Bible Belt in Holland, which is politically very marginal here, but which has great intellectual influence in the United States. And that is, it's a very, we don't, so we're not very good at national socialism, fortunately, but we are very strong in conservative Calvinism. It's like, what's his name? There's this book on, it's called Gomorrah by this American intellectual. What's his name?
Max Blumenthal. Republican Gomorrah, I believe.
Yes, that's him. That's him. He just... If you read the book, you will see the Dutch links there. To any Dutchman, they're very, you know, under the Dutch Republic, when Holland was a world power, the Calvinists were the state church. The Puritans, basically, I mean the Puritans, the Mayflower, didn't leave America from England. It left from Holland. They lived here in Leiden. Yes, but it is really, I mean, just like Santa Claus comes from Holland and New York used to be a Dutch colony, we are extremely important for America. I mean, next to Britain, perhaps we're the most important country for early US history. But that's a completely different subject from Myanmar or Burma. The problem with Burma is really it is really a Burmese problem, and the colonial past is used as an excuse. It's not the colonial problem. It's a problem of Burmese imperialism. The Burmese were conquering the entire area. They were only stopped from doing so by the British. Not that I have any sympathy for the British, but I'm being cynical now. The British stopped the Burmese from conquering the rest. Once the British left, the British gave the Burmese back what they had recently conquered, and problems started all over again between the populations there. So the main problem is a problem of Burmese nationalism and Buddhist racism. Those are the two main problems here.
When you mentioned imperialism, even though, or the way things are now, it's somewhat reliant upon this past colonial history. And then you mentioned imperialism in terms of what is going on now with the military there. That is the reason I wanted to touch on Eric Prince, Blackwater, DeVos, because yes, that is the group in the United States in which Wilders is connected to politically.
Yes.
Right?
It's true.
So,
yes.
So when we look at the military situation in Burma, and then we take into account Blackwater is a private military force that trains militaries like this to do the exact sort of what they consider to be counterinsurgency actions that are almost always directed towards indigenous people. I'm not Alex Jones. I'm not saying that this is a Dutch conspiracy. But
I understand.
This weird circle of violence that we see on how these various connections always end up going right back, where they came from.
This is the Rohingya problem is not a problem of Western influence. The West has very little influence on this problem. The West has real influence on Burma, but Burma is a very large country. And there are a lot of interests in Burma, but this is a sideshow. And this sideshow is being caused not by the West, not even by the Chinese. It's being caused by the Burmese and the Arakanese. They're the ones who are causing the problem.
Okay, so what is the role of the West in trying to stop this problem, to negate?
Well, the problem is with the West is that you have a tug of war in Burma between China and the West. So everybody wants to keep Burma as a friend. ASEAN as well. Burma is a member of ASEAN. ASEAN has a rule that they do not want to mix in the internal affairs of other of their member states. They have made an exception for Burma because things have gotten to such a level with the Rohingya that many hundreds of thousands of people are fleeing the country and burdening countries like Thailand, Malaysia, and Indonesia. So ASEAN member states for the first time are speaking out on this problem. But this is new. Well, so basically the Rohingya problem it's an internal problem. It's not a problem that any foreign actor has anything to do with.
Okay, that's established. But what, even though the West has absolutely nothing to do with this, and this is an internal problem, and it really has absolutely, no effect on the larger geopolitical hubris, that we're all concerned.
Yes, it does. It does have effect. I'm trying to tell you, it does have effect on the largest geostrategical situation because China is trying to find a way out. China has problems in the South China Sea and would like to have other avenues towards the Indian Ocean. And going through Burma is one possibility, and then they would go through Rakhine State. And the West does not want Burma to do that. to allow that. So everybody wants to keep Burma, the Burmese government, as a friend. That is why this has been made possible as well, because everybody wants to keep the government as a friend, and they look the other way with the killings.
Indonesia is the largest, you know, in terms of population anyway, the largest Muslim country in the world. It is a major player in that part of Asia. It is an economic powerhouse. It has its own issues going on with East Timor. They have a minority issue, I believe, in the north of the country. I could be wrong about that. But they have their own problems. Racialism is a big deal in Indonesia. What have they done politically, economically? Because I do know, and you mentioned it yourself, that there are so many refugees that are flooding, you know, all of these other nations. What is their position other than trying to maintain some sort of, you know, political equilibrium with Burma and at the same time keep China and U.S. off their backs in terms of being forced, you know, for them being forced in order to make a decision on what they can do to actually help these people? Is there anybody that's even willing to take on this population to remove them from the situation?
Well, I think basically, Indonesia, as a member of ASEAN, wants to stay out of the internal affairs of Burma. They do not want the fact that it's a Muslim country is in a way for the Indonesians of less importance. They prefer to stay out of the internal affairs of Burma. The only countries that have been speaking out are countries such as Malaysia and Thailand. They have been speaking out, also because they have been bearing the brunt of the refugee crisis. Malaysia has actually sent a ship this past year with food for the Rohingya people in Myanmar. And Malaysia is basically breaking the rule of the ASEAN that member states do not interfere in the internal affairs of other member states. But so far, Malaysia is the only country that has really spoken out in favor of the Rohingyas as a member of ASEAN.
As a member of ASEAN. What about India?
Well, India, again here, geopolitics plays a game, and the nature of the government in India, because the government under Modi has a nationalistic Hindu policy. So they have been very unwelcoming to the Muslim Rohingyas fleeing to India. That is one part of the problem. There are, for instance, Rohingyas in Jammu and Kashmir who are having a hard time. And I've seen reports of refugee camps in Delhi as well, where Rohingyas are being marginalized and being sent back. That is one part of India. On the other part of India, is they're in a fix in the sense that they see the Chinese influence increasing in the area, and they would like to stop China. So they are trying to, again, be good friends with the Burmese government to stop Chinese influence from taking over, which means that the Rohingyas do not have any support from the Indian government.
Okay, so let me ask you quickly so that, you know, we can all understand. How divided is the country in terms of sections, and where do the indigenous people, including the Rohingya, you know, how much of the space do they occupy?
You know, I mean, the term indigenous people in Burma is a loaded term if you know that the Burmese and the Arakanese, who are their cousins, they come originally from China. They speak a language that is faintly related to Tibetan. They don't belong in the area. They've only come there for the past 1,000 years. Before that, you had Cambodians, the Khmer. You had Hindustani peoples like the Rohingya. You had the Mon. You had different nationalities that are largely extinct. So if we're talking about indigenous people, the imperialism comes from the Burmese. And I know this is a very unpopular thing to say, but for the past 1,000 years, the Burmese and the Arakanese have been taking over the area. And they're kind of chasing away the older population groups, like the Rohingya, who were there far before the Burmese ever came.
Human trafficking is a big problem around the world, and Asia has been a problem for centuries, generations. Are the Rohingya people being exploited through the human trafficking that is rampant in that particular area, especially because, you know, traffickers could take advantage of the conflict? And that
let me use this subject to raise attention for two other problems as well. Yes, human trafficking is a problem, but there are two other serious problems as well. I will refer to those later on. Human trafficking is really a big problem for the Rohingyas in the way that people are leaving their country with boats and they're going to Malaysia and Thailand, and a lot of those people end up in slavery. Young men are enslaved on fishery ships. Young women disappear into prostitution or in a local service industry. So yes, human trafficking is a big problem, in the sense also that many Rohingyas present themselves on boats. They don't have any money, they don't have any possessions. They're completely at the mercy of the countries that receive them, and they end up in slavery. And that is a real problem. Another problem really is that the border between Bangladesh and Myanmar there is also a place where a lot of drugs are being traded, and a lot of gems, rubies for instance, are being traded there. So there is it's because the area is so poor, people try to earn money by any ways they can get. And you have these big crime syndicates who engage in human trafficking, but also in gem and drug smuggle.
Now, I wasn't aware of that. I am now, though.
That's why I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was not aware of that, because I was going to ask you about child soldiers. Because I was told by somebody casually that she had read reports in the Asian media that many of the child soldiers that the United States government has recognized this, the Obama government has recognized this and discussed it at the United Nations, that child soldiers are being used in Burma. But are they also being used by the drug cartels and from the illegal trade in precious stones?
No, you're mixing up quite a number of scenes here. The child soldier scene is far more to the east and the north of the country. We're talking about the west. Burma is a big country with an incredibly complex ethnic makeup, with a lot of civil wars going on. Actually, there are peace talks going on in the country in the north now. There is a lot of drug smuggling between Laos and Thailand and Burma. That's also to the east. And a lot of the problems of the country, a lot of the more visible problems internationally, play out on the east side of the country. This is the west. This is a part that is very poor, very backward. It's really a backwater. People don't pay attention to it until large killings take place, or people are really expelled in huge masses. It's a different problem from the child soldiers. The Rohingya do not have a military resistance either. There have been attacks in the past weeks, but they are minimal. There isn't. If you look at the geography, you don't even have space for an effective guerrilla. The Rakhine State borders the sea, but it's only about 30 kilometers deep. Let's say something like 20 plus miles deep into the country, and then you have a mountain range which fences it off from the rest of the country. You don't have space to engage in any warfare there.
Yeah, because I wanted to ask you about the Shan people, the Karen people, the Karen people. I'm a little familiar with the Karen people because there were reports that they were actually fighting the Burmese army. It was a short thing, but they had to pick up arms at one point. And I remember hearing stories of their children were missing. And I believe those came from Dutch news sources. So, you know, when we see all of this, you know, to kind of tie all of this up, you know, these other minority groups and then the Rohingya, what do you see happening, if anything, positive in terms of their survival, in terms of recognition from the international community, and more importantly, action from the international community? And, you know, what can everyday people do? Because we can't expect our politicians and even NGOs sometimes. They may write a report, but until the political will comes about, you know, how can we really push to get things done? Especially when we have conflicts with causes. You have what is happening in occupied Palestine. People here in North America are dealing with the Dakota Access Pipeline. We're dealing with very racist, yes, violent police. We have neo-Nazis that are marching. We have a president that is endorsing a lot of these things. And then we have what's happening in North Korea. So when we have a situation like this that very few people know about, but the UN at the same time is saying that this is the number one human rights crisis in the world right now, what can we do as people to try to, you know, do something for the Rohingya?
Tell your government to make the Burmese government stop this, the killing. Tell your government to give citizenship to the Rohingyas. The Rohingyas were Burmese citizens. They want to be Burmese citizens. In 1982, there was a citizenship law that took away the citizenship of the Rohingya in Burma. Tell them to make the Burmese government restore that citizenship. That will change the picture totally. If the Rohingya are admitted as Burmese citizens, there will be no more reason to expel them. There will be no more reason to persecute them. That is the core issue that we are facing now. And tell the people to follow the different outlets on Facebook, on Twitter, like Protect the Rohingya, like Rohingya Sources, like Voice of the Rohingya. Tell people to follow those sources, because there are many very dedicated people who try to help the Rohingya to survive and to make clear to the world what is actually happening. Because the Burmese government and the Arakanese want to stop people from knowing what is happening. And we have to make the world know what is happening there, so that the world will know that they have to stop the killings. Another thing is, what I would say, if I think a little bit onwards, let governments help Bangladesh. Bangladesh is supporting hundreds of thousands of refugees in Chittagong tract. In a poor country, it's already a poor country, and this area is the poorest part of the country, and there are hundreds of thousands of refugees coming over from Myanmar and finding safety in Bangladesh, which is great, because Bangladesh is a safe place, as safe goes. But it's a safe place for the Rohingyas. But the world needs to give far more support to Bangladesh to help those people and the local Bangladeshi community to get them out of poverty and to support what the wonderful work that they're doing for the Rohingya people.
You have been listening to Joy Hinson, a professor at The Hague University of Applied Sciences at The Hague, Netherlands. He is an expert on Asian relations and one of the academics behind Protect the Rohingya, an international human rights effort working to bring the Rohingya crisis to public attention and protective action. And thank you for being Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
It's my pleasure. I'm really glad to be able to talk about this because I really feel passionately for these people. Thank you for the opportunity to be able to speak out for the Rohingya. Thank you.
Thank you. You're still listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
And this is Javen Bonker, and you can catch me on Twitter, selfmade_G22. Let's Be Real podcast on Facebook. You look us up. Or are you listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio?
To join in peaceful revolution.
To honor indigenous sovereignty.
And protect the land and water.
For generations to come.
Mexicans, South Americans, all indigenous people. Get inspired.
Take action.
And become a part of the solution.
It's my future.
Your future.
Our future.
We are the protectors of Mother Earth.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up
and protect our Earth.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
And become a part of this incredible movement.
The time has come.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Become idle no more.
Nothing British is a campaign against racism and extremism. Add your voice by signing our petition at www.nothingbritish.com.
Fuck you, Trump. We'll see you on the streets. Am I disappointed? Yes. But am I surprised? Hell no.
It clearly shows what the country is made up of, what the country was founded on.
I always describe the United States as a greedy, hypocritical, racist, white supremacist, evil, warmongering nation.
Donald Trump is just a symptom of a greater system that has basically f***ed up for my people for over 500 years.
To me, the United States was founded in violence, developed in violence, and violence is an American, U.S. American tradition.
The thing that's rattling around in my brain is all of this militarized police and the attacks and everything that's been happening happened under the Obama administration. And I can't help but question what might happen under a Trump administration.
Now we have a really strong enemy to organize against that causes us to say, hey, we gotta get together.
You are listening to the Angry and Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the closing plenary of Left Forum 2017. My name is Rob Robinson.
I'm one of the members of the board of directors of this conference, and I hope you enjoyed the experience this weekend. We worked hard to put this together for you, so. We are coming to the end of another successful forum. We had close to 350 panels and workshops and over 1,100 speakers from all over the world. As with prior conferences, old relationships were rekindled and many new ones were made. The Left Forum gave space to young voices which are leading the struggles of resistance, and we featured the voices of women doing incredible work on the ground. I was personally asked this evening if Left Forum could seriously consider prioritizing the voices of the Palestinian struggle. And I assured that I was sure to ensure that individual that that would be a rich discussion on future board meetings within the Left Forum. We will not ignore any request made of us. And on that matter, I'd like to ask you to take the time this coming week as we send you an email if you're on our email list.